My name is John Sylvester. I'm a reporter with the Age newspaper. Some people call me Sly of the Underworld. There are 8 men in crime stories in the Naked City, and this is one of them. David Freeman couldn't choose his early path in life, but he could choose his name. And he did that by flicking through the phone book until he found one that he thought was the most appropriate. Freeman. Because that's what he finally was. A free man. For 12 years, David was held prisoner by a religious cult called the Family. Their aim? To survive the end of the world and become the new master race. He was given to the cult at the age of 2 and hidden with a group of children in a remote country house described as a school that was actually a prison.
They were kept there, away from society, ill-treated by sect members, and the children did not know a normal, what we would call a normal upbringing.
He was also left with lifelong trauma, anger, depression, and suicidal thoughts, fleeing to the other side of the world, then almost locked out of Australia, the country of his childhood and the country that had let him down.
In the end, I have a personal view that justice was never done.
This sort of story doesn't really happen here. You occasionally read a small snippet about some weird cult down south in the US or in some unpronounceable fiefdom in Europe, but not in a peaceful rural setting 90 minutes from Melbourne.
A barbed wire fence surrounds this property. The kids were never allowed out. But not 300 metres away is a lake. Thousands of Australians came here for holidays during the course of 2 decades. No one saw anything. No one raised the alarm.
Perhaps that's why police were slow to react and the cult was able to survive for 20 years, led by the charismatic and seriously loopy Anne Hamilton Byrne.
I love children.
She was one of the country's most notorious cult leaders, responsible for stealing children through adoption scams and subjecting them to beatings and starvation.
David spent most of his adult life trying to forget, moving to Iceland, marrying, fathering children, and working outdoors as a roof contractor until he finally understood he needed to deal with his past. He reconnected with one of the original detectives, Julie Cochran, now a clinical psychologist, and finally feels he can tell his story.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're right.
Thank you.
No worries.
David, we're just talking about Iceland. Hamilton Byrne, a Melbourne yoga teacher in the 1960s, convinced her followers she was the Latter-day Jesus, and through fake adoptions and gifts, controlled more than 20 children between 1967 and 1987. They were the chosen ones who would guide Mother Earth into peace after the inevitable doomsday. David was kept at Kailama, a secluded sprawling house at Eildon's Balti Bay, from 1975 until 1987. When he was finally rescued by police after one of the children escaped and managed to convince a local policeman they were all being held captive. The first time she escaped, he took her back. But by the time of the second, he became suspicious, pulling down the police station blinds and alerting Melbourne detectives. The kids were rescued on August 16, 1987. Seeing he was only 2 when he went there, he actually had no recollections of life before the cult. His first memory, he says, was just crying himself to sleep, missing his mother. Remember, he was 2. Talk us through an average day, if there was such a thing.
Oh, there was very much an average day. Well, every day was the same. It was a bit like Groundhog Day. You'd wake up at between 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, do meditation, do yoga, and, you know, then eat breakfast, which was fruit. Then you'd start studying straight away. study till lunchtime, and you know, once again it was vegetarian diet, so you know, some sort of vegetable mix for lunch, and then you'd study more and you'd probably finish studying 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then it was dinner, which is, you know, the same as lunch and breakfast. It was all vegetarian, and I went to bed very early because I was, you know, I was one of the youngest, so I was sent to bed as early as 7 o'clock or 7:30, and yeah, that was my day.
Imagine a childhood where there was no laughter, no affection, and a life infected with fear.
You suffered from asthma, and what did they do then?
Well, yeah, it went untreated for the entire time I was up there. The women who were looking after us, they'd get frustrated because, you know, I couldn't sleep properly at night. I'd be, you know, gasping for air and wheezing, and, you know, they'd punish me, and they'd send me out to the shed. And it seemed miles away from the house, and, yeah, they'd just send me out there with a rug, thinking that punishment would somehow stop me wheezing and gasping for air.
Well, I would have thought it'd just make it worse because you'd be so panicked.
Yeah, you were panicked. I mean, maybe the adrenaline helped. But yeah, it was pretty scary to be out there in the middle of the night.
A small shed in a remote area of Victoria, surrounded by animals, noises. How terrifying would that be for a kid? They were tended by two women at a time, residents of Melbourne, who were ordered to oversee the student inmates. Up to 12 lived at the property at a time. Alton Byrne ordered the women to complete 2-week shifts before being replaced by another team. These women must have been filled with resentment, living their own lives, and ordered to go up in 2-week shifts to look after kids they didn't know.
And the carers, who are called aunties, they sort of came up from Melbourne on shifts.
Yeah. They came up for 2 weeks at a time, and when they finished their shift, they'd go back down to Melbourne and work as nurses for 2 weeks, and that just went on, yeah, for years and years.
Occasionally, the cult leader would arrive at Eildon herself. She would tell the kids that she was their mother.
It was weird. She had sort of some sort of celebrity status. And I think she gave herself that celebrity status. She'd just sort of swan into town and, you know, we'd all sort of swoon and smile, and it was, you know, it was like Christmas. I mean, you had nothing ever to look forward to up there. So when she came to town, and we thought that was fantastic, you know, when we were much younger. But then as the years wore on, she came up there less and less. She'd promised she'd come for Christmas or for our birthdays or whatever, and she just, you know, year after year, she just wouldn't show up.
She was obsessed with education, which means the kids worked hard in a boarding school environment. When they were finally freed and went back into the normal education system, they found that academically they were so far in front of their peers, but emotionally, of course, so far behind.
There was a huge emphasis put on education up there, and, you know, we studied 7 days a week. And obviously had the idea that we had to be a lot smarter than the average child out there. So the education was very thorough. Being one of the youngest, I was more or less being educated at the same level that the older children were as well. So, yeah, when I got to Presill, I remember the first day or two, I sat down and, you know, I was a bit overwhelmed by the whole experience of suddenly going to a real school. But I realised that they were teaching material that I'd learned 3 to 4 years ago.
You were tiny because of the diet you were on, so.
Yeah, I was well under average height and weight of a normal 14-year-old. I mean, I really looked like 9 years old. I had to have growth hormone therapy to get myself up to, you know, the normal height and weight.
Now, I know we at Naked City have been missing for a while, and you will have flirted with other podcasts. Some of you even may be craving an open relationship. But we're back now,
and all is forgiven. And so why not subscribe to the podcast so the bosses let us back into the studio rather than forcing us to record this in a rent-by-the-hour motel with a live audience of cockroaches? And while you are feeling generous, subscribe to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald. You won't regret it. Well, you might, but we've already got your money by then.
Hamilton Byrne travelled the world, developed a taste for designer fashions and cosmetic surgery, and amassed a fortune that police would estimate was worth $50 million, thanks to donations from her followers.
Anne's followers included dozens of respected middle-class professionals, doctors, nurses, lawyers, teachers, all willing to do the bidding of their master.
I was told to leave my first wife and go up to the hills. I did. I was told that I would be going to have a baby with another woman, and I did.
At a later class action, David and five of the other children received a paltry $21,000 each in compensation for having their childhoods stolen.
She had claimed 27 children came through her hands, but at its peak, the family had 500 members based in the Dandenongs.
She intermarried.
The children had their hair dyed platinum blonde and styled in identical bobs.
And to convince outsiders they were all related, Anne dyed their hair blonde.
Bleached hair, blonde, singing like the Von Trapp family, living out Anne's fantasy of, in her thoughts, I'm sure it was something like an Aryan race. Horrific. Even
Anne. Life was bleak and adults were to be feared. David said they were brought up as robots and there was just no love and no compassion. He recalls crying for so long he ran out of tears. When one of the carers uncharacteristically gave him a peck on the head, tucked him in and said goodnight, he thought, what the hell was that? Hamilton Byrne told the children they had been chosen to lead the world. One boy was selected to be the overall world leader, but when he fell out of favour, one of the girls was picked as a replacement. Julie Cochran was a senior detective at the Tactical Investigation Group when she moved to the Forest Task Force, the group selected to investigate the family. She said she was shocked when she first learnt what had happened.
I think one of the things that stood out was how did this go on for so long? Because there were this group of children that had grown up in a very deprived way, in a way they'd lost their childhood. And how was it that these adults could do this to them, you know, systematically over a number of years, treat them in this way? The other thing that stands out, I think, is getting to meet this core group of children, different personalities. It was something that I hadn't come across before on this kind of a scale.
Peter Spence was the first head of Forest, a hard-nosed, well-respected detective. I remember sitting talking with him when he started telling me about Hamilton Byrne and the cult. To be frank, I thought he was exaggerating. To be honest, I was wrong and he was right. Cochran says Hamilton Byrne was not some sort of misguided spiritual figure, but a sadist who once beat a young girl with a stiletto shoe.
Were the children ever hit?
No, I can never say we went out to hit the children, never.
Never went out to hit them, but were
never
they
never hit them, no.
You never hit your child?
No.
Let me read you something here. This is from Sarah's book. Anne had a stiletto-heeled shoe in her hand and she started hitting me. A stiletto-heeled shoe. On my bare backside with the shoe. After about 20 or 30 hits, she got tired and Bill took over. He hit me with his hands. My head kept hitting the wall and I saw tears. Is she making that up?
You know quite well they can.
They can what? Make things up?
Kids can make things up. We've all been kids.
You were a monster at times.
I have nothing to say because I don't feel like one.
The full-time Eildon kids were routinely assaulted, with one receiving up to 10 beatings a day. There were allegations of rape. Many were given LSD. Hamilton Byrne took a jar of bull ants and threatened to pour them down the back of one of the boys' shirts. Julie found the allegations credible, and even now wonders if more should have been done.
Putting your detective hat back on, you were somewhat disappointed there weren't more serious charges against Hamilton Byrne and others.
It's hard for me to comment on that because I'd left the task force at that stage, but my understanding at the point that I left was that there were some extremely serious assaults, including there were rapes, and some very clear accounts by people who were now adults of what had happened to them in their childhood and teenage years. So my understanding was that those serious assaults and rapes were going to be pursued, or at least the alleged offenders were interviewed with a view to laying charges. I don't have an understanding as to why that didn't happen, but yeah, it does deeply concern me that somehow it seems like there wasn't that kind of outcome where at least people were interviewed and briefs of evidence put together with a view to them facing court.
Despite an investigation that lasted 6 years, clear evidence of child abuse, allegations of rape, fake adoptions and criminal activity, Hamilton Byrne and her stooge husband, Melbourne academic Bill, were fined just $5,000 each for falsifying stat decks after they were caught and extradited from the US.
The former leader of the sect known as the Family was a frail figure walking into court with her husband, William. Both now 72, they admitted conspiring to falsify New Zealand documents 10 years ago over the birth of three children she claimed were her triplets. The three were among several raised by the Hamilton Byrnes and women called aunties at an Eildon property.
It's a bit like criticising Hannibal Lecter for poor table manners. David was a smart and curious boy, and his only respite from this hell was in books. By the age of 11, the stories he read showed him life wasn't supposed to be like this. Stories such as Enid Blyton's Faraway Tree showed how children were supposed to have fun and adults were supposed to be protective. An illustrated book on camping became his favourite. There were pictures of a dad and two smiling kids going fishing. It showed him what life should be like.
Well, seeing this is all you knew, how did you work out that this wasn't normal, that it wasn't just everyone lived like this?
Well, I was just inherently curious. I just had to know everything, and I was just curious. You know, I'd look at everything around me, I'd listen to everything, and I'd read everything. And, you know, I was still pretty young when it started to dawn on me that other kids out there, you know, the rest of the world was leading different lives. And, you know, they were having fun and doing things that we could only dream of.
What sort of books sort of introduced you to the outside world, if you like?
I mean, you know, you had your favourites, like mine was Enid Blyton books and books like that. And you'd read books from America and England and all these countries, and they all sort of said the same thing, that people were having fun, people were doing, they were enjoying their lives and they were having a real childhood. And that's why, you know, I was still pretty young and I started thinking, you know, this is not right. There's something really wrong. And also just, you know, I mean, the constant punishment and all that. I didn't read about other kids having to go through that sort of thing in their day-to-day lives.
Every day he prayed for freedom, but when that day arrived, his nightmare was far from over. The children were taken into care at the St. John's Home for Boys and Girls. Eventually, the children were reallocated to family homes, all except David, who remained in government care. His mother, it was later discovered, lived in England, and his father denied any connection. The children became a little bit famous for a time, and David hated the notoriety, and at the age of 15, he made himself a promise. He would never speak a word about his childhood.
Well, I was seen as an object of curiosity because the court cases were in full swing, and the police were, you know, trying to charge people, and it was on the television every night, you know, of course, on our current affairs style shows, and on the news, and then when people realised that I was one of the children from the family, they inevitably they were curious and they wanted to know more, and nah, I couldn't stand that.
Yeah, because you want to be normal.
Well, yeah, I wanted to fly under the radar. I was ashamed of my past and how strange it was, and how, you know, how bizarre the whole story was. I just certainly didn't want any attention. I did not want to be in the spotlight for a second.
So is it right you made a decision just to shut it off?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was 15 years old, I just told myself that I would never tell another person ever where I came from. And I did that. And I did that until I was 40 years old.
At the age of 18, he was released from government care with little support. He was offered accommodation in a halfway house, and that was about it. He worked for a while, started travelling the world, and at a kibbutz in Israel met a girl and followed her to Iceland. All he wanted was a normal life, so he put all his terrible childhood experiences in a lockbox. For 25 years he didn't tell his partner, his children, or his best friends. Often we revert to the experiences we had as children. For David, it was exactly the opposite. He tried to give his children what he never had. If they cried, he picked them up, kissed them, and tried to make them feel safe.
Exactly the opposite upbringing that I'd been given. And that's quite interesting how it worked out that way. That I didn't, you know, that the cycle of violence ended there, and or the cycle of abuse ended there. And that I think that's quite amazing. I don't understand it from a psychological viewpoint, but I think it's interesting that I actually managed to do that. But
so you'd hold them and...
Oh, I took it to extremes. I'd be told off for holding them too much. I mean, I wouldn't let them cry. If I heard them cry, that just brought back memories, and I would stop it instantly. So I got told off by grandmothers and so on for, you know, picking up spoiled brats.
By the time he was 40, he could no longer suppress the past. There were unexplained flashes of anger, mood swings, depression, and suicidal thoughts. He took to alcohol and self-medicated with drugs. The low point was at a two-story car park when he had the noose around his neck and was about to jump when his phone rang. It was his daughter. That call pulled him back from the brink.
Day-to-day living had just become, you know, hell. You'd wake up and you knew you had to go to work and face people and face your social phobia and all that, and then, I mean, you know, when you've only got that to look forward to, there's only one way out. No, that's the way I saw it. I only had one option. And I still couldn't talk about it, really, to psychologists and people like that. I still couldn't sort of get it out, and so I still wasn't dealing with it. So, yeah, that seemed like the only alternative.
He sought help in Iceland and then reached out to the initial task force investigator, Julie Cochran. That connection helped David on the long road back. Cochran says David is thoughtful, sensitive, and remarkably resilient. When I asked him about the aunties who were helpers who brutalised them all, he says they'd been forced to go to Wildon for their two-week shifts, and when asked about Hamilton Byrne, he says, "She was a sick woman. I feel sorry for her. She died in June 2019, aged 98, leaving an estate worth millions." While he's coming to terms with his past, certain events take him back. When he returns to Australia, the smell of eucalyptus and Australian bird noises can give him the chills. While living in Iceland and fighting for his mental health, David let his Australian residency lapse. In early March 2023, David Freeman was granted a one-year working visa to stay in Australia. He can then apply for a second year with the expectation it would flow on to an Australian citizenship application.
It's certainly not restorative justice, but it is a start. We turned our backs on this little boy and those other kids that were locked in a hellhole in the middle of an idyllic bush setting all those years ago. Surely we're not going to do it again. I'm John Sylvester, and this episode was produced by Hannah Mills Turbitt, mixed by Cormac Lally. The director of podcasting is David McMillan. Archives, thanks to Nine. And remember, as the great Anthony Quayle reminded us in The Evil Touch, there is indeed a touch of evil in all of us.
So, until we meet again, this is Anthony Quayle saying there is a touch of evil in all of us. Good night. Pleasant dreams.